how do you create a quiet moment on a page is such a hard lesson to learn, I think. And because you have to fill it with words, but you also want it to have this feeling.
Nina LaCour never rushes through a moment. Instead, she encourages her readers to linger in the space, to contemplate, and to fully experience each second. She invites us to be deep observers of the world, which is exactly what she believes makes a great writer.
I did a few little free events for kid writers through the San Francisco Library, and I would take them like on a little walk and tell them, we're going to look and we're going to see like what you want to put in your stories, and we're going to listen, and we're going to eavesdrop, and we're going to spy on people. And like, that is how you become a writer, like by paying attention to the world.
Nina LaCour's gentle and thoughtful approach to deep and complex topics have resonated with young readers and adults alike. She's known for her novels such as Hold Still, Everything Leads to You, and We Are Okay, which received the Michael L. Prince Award for Excellence in Young Adult Literature. In this episode, she'll tell us how and why she fell in love with YA, about her admiration for writing's ability to bring out the depth in every second. And she reveals which classic 20th century novel not only influenced her writing style, but also led to her very own meet cute with a storybook ending. And of course, she tells us the origin story of her signature bangs. My name is Jordan Lloyd Bookie, and this is The Reading Culture, a show where we speak with authors and illustrators about ways to build a stronger culture of reading in our communities. We dive into their personal experiences, their inspirations, and why their stories and ideas motivate kids to read more. Make sure to check us out on Instagram for giveaways at The Reading Culture Pod, and subscribe to our newsletter at thereadingculturepod.com/newsletter. All right, on to the show. Okay, so Nina, you grew up in the Bay Area, but like not quite San Francisco, right? It's close by. Can you just describe what life was like for you growing up there?
I was born and raised in a small Bay Area suburb called Moraga. It is right through the tunnel from Oakland, California. It's a really, really little town. It doesn't have a freeway exit. At first, I think I felt pretty comfortable there. And as I got older, I just felt isolated and confined by it. And really longed for anonymity. So as soon as I could, I moved to San Francisco and started college there when I was 17 and went to San Francisco State, which was the opposite kind of where I was from. It was still the Bay Area, but a big public school, largely a commuter school. It was super diverse in every way possible. And the big lecture hall settings where I could just be one person in a theater listening to someone really smart talk about something they were passionate about. And it was exactly where I wanted to be.
When you're growing up, did you feel like very known? Like, hey, there's Nina. Was that what the kind of community it was?
Definitely. I mean, it was really small. I went largely with the same kids from elementary school through high school. I never felt like I really belonged there, even though I was known there. And I'm still kind of unpacking that and exploring why. There were some like very obvious reasons. It's a very, very affluent town. It's a town where almost everybody owns their own homes. My parents moved there when my mom was pregnant with me. They had no roots there. We didn't buy a house. We rented a couple apartments over the years. And there was even a term, apartment kids. And I was one of the apartment kids. Like, there are that few apartments there. So I definitely felt on the outskirts in that way. It was very kind of country clubby. And then also kids did sports, and I never did sports, but that was a real kind of source of community there too. And I was just this kind of quiet outsider feeling, you know, artsy, dreamy kid. And even though I knew everybody, I didn't quite feel like I knew where I belonged.
Were you like bullied as a kid, or did you just feel outside of it? Like, I don't know, was school like a safe space for you?
I wasn't bullied, no. I always had like a close friend or a few more. I wouldn't say I was picked on, but I think that I was very, very shy, like incredibly shy, and had trouble talking in class. And I also struggled academically in school, which made me feel, you know, inadequate and kind of confused. I'm certain I have some undiagnosed learning disabilities that just kind of flew under the radar because I didn't do poorly enough. I didn't fail things, but I certainly did not excel. I mean, it's been very interesting. I have a 10-year-old. And so looking back on elementary school and what that was like and kind of like seeing some similar experiences reflected has been just very fascinating. And as you, for all of your listeners and you who have children, like, I feel like it's this portal to reexamining what we were like at that age. It just brings me closer to childhood all the time, having her and witnessing her experiences.
You said you had maybe some learning differences that were never diagnosed, but were you a big reader and writer? Like, did you like to do those things from a young age?
Yes, definitely. I loved reading. I mean, as soon as I could read, I was reading constantly. And writing was always my thing. Storytelling always was. I would dictate stories before I knew how to write them. I wrote poetry all the time.
What do you mean you'd dictate them?
Like to my parents, I would say, here is my story. And I would say it out loud and they would write it down. But storytelling has just been the way that I engage with the world, and reading too. It's always been a core part of who I am.
Got it. Okay. And so were your parents big readers?
They were readers for sure. Like in the apartment where I grew up, we had our dining room table in this little like alcove off the kitchen and living room. And the whole wall was a bookshelf. And yeah, there were always books coming in and out, but there were also books that just kind of like were fixtures on this bookshelf. And I would stare at them and think about them and pick them off the shelves. And when I got older, I start reading them. And I feel like because we were like a sit down at the dinner table type family, it meant every night of my childhood, I'd be staring at these books as the backdrop to dinner. And I mean, I can remember their spines. So clearly that impacted me. They both read. My mom read novels all the time. My dad read the newspaper every single morning, the San Francisco Chronicle, and would also read novels sometimes and nonfiction books. And they were... Yeah, we were a big reader family for sure.
Yeah, I like that image of you, of the breakfast books coming in like by osmosis. Did you have any teachers who could tell that you were a good writer? I heard you tell a story. It was a heartbreaking story that you told. Your teacher was about to read your story and you like knew that she was going to reveal that you're this great writer to the class.
That was fifth grade. And yeah, by that time, I don't remember really getting like feedback on my creative writing. Because I think I don't remember ever being singled out as like a good writer or anything like that. But yeah, fifth grade, we had a short story assignment and I was just elated. I've just been like waiting for a short story assignment. All I did was do creative writing. At that time, I was reading like Anne of Green Gables and The Secret Garden and like all of these kind of older books that really are like very heavy in description and very wordy, you know. And I still remember it so well. Like I had this vision for the story of this like elderly woman sitting like up in a house with a lace curtain looking down and seeing this man approaching, like a young man. And I think she was going to tell him like the story of her life. So I was a fifth grader, like this was a grand story that I was conceptualizing here. And I was just setting up the beginning. And I remember my teacher read it aloud and I was just terrified and so excited. And I had just put so much effort into like every detail and I had such a clear image in my head. And then she said, okay, so this is an example of too much detail. And it was so crushing. I didn't do sports. I was not an especially strong student in any way. I was not popular. What I had was that I was a reader and a writer. Like that was my identity, you know, that's the only thing I ever felt good at. So having her use my story in that way was really crushing. I'm sure far more crushing than she ever would have imagined.
Yeah. But still, that's a little harsh, you know? All right, let's move on to some of your reading life as a kid. Can you talk a little bit about some of the books that you were really drawn to when you were younger throughout elementary or middle school?
I remember reading the Barbara Kingsolver books, like The Bean Trees and Pigs in Heaven. Those were two that were on the shelf. And my dad, one time in high school, pulled down this anthology, or I guess just a collected stories of Raymond Carver's, who was like a very well-respected short story writer in the 80s. And they're full of smoking and drinking and working hard and like really dysfunctional relationships. And I just loved them. They're full of this sort of feeling of like discontent and of almost desperation, but very quiet at the same time. And there's a lot of uncertainty and ambiguity in them. And they're super spare, which really drew me in. And once my dad introduced me to those stories, I just read them over and over and over again and studied them. And I feel like they were kind of my first lessons in creative writing that were like my own. Like I had taken in junior high, I took creative writing and stuff like that. But like, this was the first time that high school age where I was like, I want to write like this. How do I do it? How does he do this? How does he create this sort of like feeling? There's a lot of really quiet moments. Like, how do you create a quiet moment on a page is such a hard lesson to learn, I think, because you have to fill it with words, but you also want it to have this feeling. And so I studied him, and then I wrote like all these short stories that were just Raymond Carver ripoffs, which are very, I mean, it's very funny, but some of his style, I think, still does kind of linger in my work in some ways.
It's not hard to see that inspiration in Nina's work. In each page, paragraph, and sentence, there is an active choice to be sparse, to be intentional with every word. There's no overcomplicating or diluting the power of the moment, allowing us to slow down and appreciate the depth of it. Nina's skill in this style is evident. It made me wonder if this careful and intentional observant behavior is something that goes back to her childhood. I asked her about it.
Oh, yes, yes. I feel like all I did was observe. I feel like I really had trouble just like understanding what was happening in the world. Like I just felt like a lost. I was just like searching for cues constantly. And my favorite thing to do would be to just like sit and write and like look at the world and write and, you know, slowly get ideas and be inspired. And I loved eavesdropping and hearing how people spoke to each other and engaged with each other. And recently I did a few little free events for kid writers through the San Francisco Library. And I would take them like on a little walk and tell them, we're going to look and we're going to see like what you want to put in your stories. And we're going to listen and we're going to eavesdrop and we're going to spy on people. That is how you become a writer, like by paying attention to the world. And that's definitely what the majority of my time was spent doing.
I do think that that's so much of your work. I'm thinking about, I think it's Watch Over Me, when like Lee brings her breakfast. She like actually speaks those words to herself, remember these things. And I think that is the feeling you have maybe of reading your books is like a, remember this thing happened and that thing happened. And you kind of, everything gets its own little explanation. So you're not forgetting those things, you know?
Yeah, thank you so much. That's such a beautiful reading of my work and what I try to do. I really appreciate that.
Nina is acclaimed for bringing those carefully observed details and personal experiences to young adult fiction, building a world for adolescent characters that feels genuine and lived in. As it turns out, writing that way, and even writing for young readers at all, came about only after a discouraging misstep early in her career when she tried writing an adult book with characters much older than herself.
Yeah, so I was in college, creative writing major, and I wrote a lot of short stories, and my writing was very succinct, and I didn't know how to write a novel yet at all, but I knew I wanted to write one. And I started writing these scenes and they were for an adult novel. They were adult characters. It was multi-generational. I had all these scenes. I didn't know how to turn them into a novel yet, but they did get me into Mills College where I went for grad school. And I then had the task of having to put together 40 consecutive pages for a workshop. And I was like, that is more than I've ever written. I was writing these 10 to 15 page short stories. And so I did. And it just like, it wasn't good, you know, it had some moments and, but mostly it wasn't good. And it was just like a horrible experience for me, just emotionally. And I held it together. And then I went into the restroom and I sobbed and during the break. And then I went back in and did the next person's workshop. I just felt humiliated and like exposed as a fraud. Like I just, it was really, really hard. And I put that novel aside for a while. And I think I just wasn't ready to write it. It was too complicated for like my skill set at the time.
Yeah. I mean, you were a baby too. Like you sort of needed the, didn't you need like your life experience to write about people having a life experience, you know?
Totally. Absolutely. Yeah. I was 21. I didn't know anything about what I was writing, trying to write about. And so I set it aside and then I took a young adult literature class, which was great because as we were just talking about, like there wasn't that much YA that was out there when I was a teenager. And I then got to like go back and read the things that had been published during that time. And it was like during the time in between. And it was such a cool class. And I was really drawn to adolescent literature. And I started writing what turned into my first novel, Hold Still, while I was in that class. And then I just kept writing YA novels.
Years later, Nina finally did get back to that original adult novel, now titled Yerba Buena, thanks, of all things, to the COVID pandemic. And this time, with the wisdom of a few more years, she nailed it.
I was working as a high school teacher and I had no time to like just pick up this project that was not a contracted project. And so even though those characters kept living in my mind and I kept thinking like, I really do want to go back to them, I would do it like a little bit between projects and then realize like, okay, I've got to write the next, you know, real book. And then during the pandemic, suddenly there was so much time, you know, because we weren't going anywhere. And I was just like, I'm going to work on this. And I just had a few like incredibly prolific months where I worked on that book. And then I wrote The Apartment House on Poppy Hill, my first chapter book. And everyone coped with that time differently. And I coped with it by just writing nonstop, basically. She stood by the fireplace talking in that beautiful voice, which made everything she said sound like a caress to Papa, who had begun to be attracted rather against his will. He never got over lending her one of his books and finding it soaked on the terrace. When suddenly she said, "What a shame to sit indoors." And they all went out onto the terrace and walked up and down. Peter Walsh and Joseph Breitkopf went on about Wagner. She and Sally fell a little behind. Then came the most exquisite moment of her whole life, passing a stone urn with flowers in it. Sally stopped, picked a flower, kissed her on the lips. The whole world might have turned upside down. The others disappeared. There she was, alone with Sally. And she felt that she had been given a present, wrapped up, and told just to keep it, not to look at it. A diamond, something infinitely precious, wrapped up, which, as they walked up and down, she uncovered, or the radiance burnt through, the revelation, the religious feeling, when old Joseph and Peter faced them. "Stargazing?" said Peter. It was like running one's face against a granite wall in the darkness. It was shocking. It was horrible. Not for herself. She felt only how Sally was being mauled already, maltreated. She felt his hostility, his jealousy, his determination to break into their companionship. All this she saw as one sees a landscape in a flash of lightning. And Sally, never had she admired her so much, gallantly taking her way unvanquished. She laughed. She made old Joseph tell her the names of the stars, which he liked doing very seriously. She stood there. She listened. She heard the names of the stars.
Wow, what a passage. Virginia Woolf really knew how to make a moment last. This passage is from her beloved work, Mrs. Dalloway, a novel that takes place over the course of a single day. By the way, Nina and her wife actually met in a course on Virginia Woolf during college.
We had actually met a year prior, but she didn't remember me. But I remembered her. Like, she walked into a room and I was like, who is that? And it was over for me. Oh. And then I waited and waited, but it's an enormous school, San Francisco State, and we didn't intersect for like a year. And then she walked into Virginia Woolf class and I was elated because I had just been hoping to have another chance. We have a big poster of a painting of Virginia Woolf like in our entryway. Yes.
Virginia Woolf puts the world in slow motion. In real life, time is fixed. We can be intentional about appreciating every moment as much as possible, but the frustrating part is that it will always pass just the same. It's only in retrospect that we're able to analyze and appreciate each second for what it is. In writing, we can break down a moment, put the world on pause, reflect deeply on every word, every movement. It was through encountering works like Woolf's that Nina learned to appreciate this unique ability of writing.
I mean, Virginia Woolf is very challenging, and I was trying my best, you know, to understand. And still, you know, when I read her, it takes effort. But the thing that I just got from studying her and from reading so many, almost all of her writing in this class, was just how she does take a moment. And all of these different moments, and some of them are so brief, like this one, like a fleeting kiss on the lips, right? I picture it as such a fast, just like a tiny, tiny fraction of a second. But that stays with her and is central almost to this entire book. It was the happiest moment of her life. And now we have Clarissa Dalloway in middle age throwing this party, and she's remembering her youth, and like, this is the moment. And there are other moments in the book and in Virginia Woolf's other novels too, where it's like a very subtle thing and not a kiss, like a feeling that passes between people or some image or something, but that's so meaningful. And I really took that with me, I think, in my writing. And I continue to just like try to to reveal some of these moments in life that just change everything or make us understand things in a way that we hadn't before.
Yeah, it's so true that is definitely like reminiscent of your writing and just that deep, deep exploration. But then that moment, that landscape, that's just like how fast it is, but also how fast we can, as people, how we, if we let ourselves, how you can dwell on or really think through something that is just a brief moment, how it can change things. You do, like, I think in a lot of your writing, look for those, like something that is seemingly small, but actually is like a life-changing moment, you know, that a person like realizes then or in retrospect.
I love that you brought up that breakfast scene and Watch Over Me, because, you know, I think that something like that, like just being cared for, can be such a, you know, incredible moment too. And wanting to remember, I mean, I think I spend a lot of time trying to hope that I'll remember little things and how a certain simple thing felt. And writing is one way of trying to capture that feeling, even if I'm fictionalizing it still. It's like I'm trying to capture the feeling in a way that will last.
I love that. And I love the phrase, a certain simple thing felt, because it really comes across in your novels. And actually, I'm curious, because you've also done a picture book. Well, what led to the picture book? And did that notion, that idea of a simple thing felt, did that also still play a role in a book for, you know, much younger audience?
I was teaching at Hamline University. We had so many wonderful lecturers who work there on the faculty. And I was listening to these lectures from Phyllis Root and Jacqueline Briggs Martin. And they are just these phenomenal children's book writers. I wanted to do what they do. Like, I really wanted to learn from them. And so I attended their lectures and I did their exercises. And in a kind of circuitous way, it led me to my first picture book called Mommy and Mama and Me in the Middle. And, oh, actually, it's called Mama and Mommy and Me in the Middle.
I admit that I was afraid to say it because I'm like, I don't remember which one comes first. So I'm just like, your picture book.
Yeah.
But then you mess it up, so it makes me feel better. Okay, go ahead. We'll link to the actual book. So.
Yeah. It was called Me in the Middle.
Oh, really?
Originally. Oh. But I love that they wanted to change it because they wanted
clear
it to be
very
recognizably.
Yes.
Yeah, queer parents. So it was funny because even though I've taught writing for so long and I'm always telling my students, like, the way that you see the world is what you bring to your work. You don't have to write like anybody else. You don't have to tell a new story. Like, there is no such thing. It's just the way that you see the world is what makes your work special and worthy. And yet, for my own picture book, I was like, I need to have a big concept. I need to tell the story of something big and important. And I went on this deep, like, exploration. We had a brief time where my family lived in Martinez, California, which is where John Muir lived, a naturalist and conservationist. So we went to the John Muir house and I was learning about his daughters. And I thought, okay, this is great. Like, I'm going to write a book about John Muir going out in the world and his daughters missing him.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yes. And at this time, like, I was spending 10 days at a time in Minnesota away from my daughter and my wife, and they missed me when I was gone, right? Yeah. But that was the feeling that I thought that I needed something more important. And so I did all of this research and I had a manuscript and I felt really good about it. And I had read all the journals of John Muir's daughters. And then I just, like, woke up one night and I was like, why am I not reading anything about the indigenous people? And then I started doing research and I'm just like, oh, he was terrible to them. He wrote horrible things. Like, in his effort to, like, preserve land, he was also kicking people who had been, like, the stewards of that land, you know, for an astronomically longer time than he had been there, like, off the land. And then I was like, I'm not writing this story. And then I, like, still have this manuscript and I'm like, okay, maybe I just write a story about our family.
They miss me. Yeah.
I mean, it was funny, but it was just like, oh, wait, like, all we need is a simple story. Like, all I need is to show a story about, like, a kid who misses one parent while the other parent's away for work. And then once I just embraced it, I realized, like, that's a more powerful story for a kid anyway, like, more recognizable, just daily life.
Throughout Nina's work, the most fitting descriptor for her style, in my opinion, is undoubtedly gentle. She's masterful at digging deep and peeling back layers, but always with a soft, non-abrasive touch. She doesn't shy away from difficult subject matter. Instead, she guides the reader through it delicately and tenderly. I asked her how she felt about the word gentle describing her writing.
The first thing that comes to me is, like, I take writing for teenagers very seriously and for children very seriously. And I have always written about difficult topics. Like, my first book was about suicide. Like, you know, I write about grief. I write about mental health, like, all sorts of hard things. But I have always also really wanted and cared a lot about showing also the beauty and the gentleness and the love and connection in life at the same time. Sometimes in the saddest moments of the books, I'll purposefully focus on something that's really beautiful or soft or comforting at the same time. Like, because I do think that's how life is. Like, I just had the image of, like, sobbing in a soft bed. It's like, we don't, like, yeah. Right? It's like, we're always, whether it's other people offering us comfort or us trying to, like, comfort ourselves in some way, like, we find a way, like, or, like, we go out and we take a hike and we're, like, in nature and we're feeling tremendous grief or anger or something, but it's like, here is the world letting us know that it's got us in some way. And as an author, I want my readers of any age, really, I do feel like, okay, I've got you, like, we're doing this, but we're doing it together. And that's kind of where I go, I guess, like, as a creative person. Like, I'm trying to not, like, hide from the hard things, but I'm also trying to offer some sort of solace at the same time.
I'm thinking of, like, so many of your books, that is the, yeah, you're, one thing's happening, but something else is happening. I guess it's a little different writing for adults. Did you find that where you can be a little, the comfort doesn't have to be as strong?
I did. Yeah, I did find that. And right now I'm nearing the second revision of my next adult novel. And it is a different experience writing for adults. Like, we have a lot of life experience at this point. And, you know, I think like some of the same tone comes through, but I also do feel less of a responsibility. It's like my responsibility becomes like to the book and the story and not necessarily like the emotional well-being of my reader.
Does it feel liberating in some way, I guess, to not feel like you have to take care of the reader as much?
Yeah, it definitely does. Yeah.
Is it growing on you, that feeling of like...
Yes.
You're like, let me write another one. I'm going to try this one another time.
I mean, I love it all.
Nina's work has exceptional queer representation, but in an incidental way. Like, it's not the point of the story, but it's there. And given this, I was curious about the reaction she's received from kids who read her work, especially during her school visits.
It's changed so much over time. I mean, my first novel came out in 2009, I believe. Back then, my main character in that, in Hold Still, is not queer, but her friend Dylan is. And when I would bring it up, like in school visits, there would often be like an uncomfortable like snicker or this feeling that it was like taboo in some way. And of course, the kids react in all sorts of different ways when they're just like, feeling a little self-conscious or nervous or whatever. Like, I didn't take that to be a huge like homophobic statement or something. But clearly now when I talk to high schoolers, it's a totally different environment. I mean, I think that just like understanding of queerness and the all of the different ways that young people are identifying and expressing themselves and everything that they're open to has just shifted so much. But my favorite thing recently was I was reading Mama and Mommy and Me in the Middle at the LA Times Book Festival, Festival of Books. And I had such an enthusiastic young audience. These kids were so adorable.
Especially if you've been reading to high schoolers for a lot of years.
Exactly.
You got to do a lot to get, you know, to get them like moving.
Yes, yes. And I was so not, I wasn't used to it at all, you know, and I was like, hello, little children. And so I'm reading the book and there are these twin little guys like up close to the stage. And one of them's hand was just like, up in the air, just waving and waving and waving through the whole book. And the book is just a book about the week. It's a book about missing people. And the family of three is front and center, but it is incidental queerness. You know, it's like, it's just two parents, one's on a trip. The little guy, like, I finally call on him and he goes, we have two moms. And he's just like exploding with needing to tell me this. And it was just the sweetest thing in the world. Like, I was like, yes, you know, and we don't need to get into book banning on this, but that's just like one of the things where I'm just like, this is real life. Like, we are all different and this is real life. And these kids are not being exposed to like anything remotely harmful and just being able to like see themselves reflected or see like their parents, you know, or see like their friends' parents,
their teachers'
family structure
reflected.
Like, exactly. Exactly. Like, here we are. We are real. We are here. We are not harming anybody. It just filled me with joy being able to like receive that comment, hear that from this young reader.
I did have another question for you. One more question. A hard hitter. Have you always had bangs? Bangs are like, that's like your signature. So I need to know, like, you know,
Yes. Okay. Thank you for asking. I feel very passionately about bangs and I had them as a child. And then I think I maybe didn't have them for a while, but then in high school, I got them again. And only once have I not had bangs in my adult life. Once I grew them out. And I used to have like a chin length bob for a long time. And it was like around that time I grew them out. And then I remember, well, you'll appreciate this because I don't even know where this came from, but because you live in DC, I didn't have them and I got this cut, like haircut. And I was like, I feel like a senator's wife.
They were like feathered.
It just like was not me. And then I was like, okay, bangs again.
For her reading challenge, At the Intersection, Nina has curated a list of books at the intersection of queerness and family.
Sometimes, like when we're looking at children's literature and queerness, I think sometimes the queer family stories can be kind of skipped over. And of course, stories about sexual and gender orientation in children is important. But like when children aren't really thinking very much about their own sexuality, seeing the queer family as its own element is so important. And I know like for raising our daughter, there are so few depictions of queer families in the media at all. And so I really wanted that. But then I also thought, as we grow, you know, as people grow up, queer families start to look different, and what we even consider family can look different. And so I have started with picture books, and then I've gone through adult novels as well, because I thought, why not have like a whole range?
I love it.
Yeah.
And what are a couple of the books on there?
So one is Mr. Watson's Chickens. I also wanted to include Brandy Colbert's The Only Black Girls in Town, because it's a great story with two dads, and it's also very much about family life. And then I have some adult ones. One is Memorial by Brian Washington, which is a fantastic look too at queerness and family. And this one, the queer characters are the adult protagonists, but it's very much about origins and family.
This episode's Beanstack featured librarian is Faith Rice Mills, librarian at Nelda Sullivan Middle School in Pasadena, Texas. She tells us a heartwarming story to remind librarians of the importance of their work, even when that impact isn't so obvious.
A few years ago, we had this book club for just girls called the Rebel Girls Book Club, and we called it that based on the book Goodnight Stories for Rebel Girls, which is a collection of one-pagers about women who made a difference in history. And of course, we didn't exclude boys. I told them they were welcome to join if they wanted to. We didn't exclude anybody from any gender, but it was girls who showed up. Throughout the year, we read three books. They would go home and read, and then we'd talk about it. And for example, one of them was One for the Murphys, which is about a girl who goes into foster care. So there was a student who came every time, but she didn't really talk. I couldn't get much out of her. So I didn't know if she liked the book club, if she was learning anything. I couldn't tell because she just didn't talk. She didn't really talk to the other girls, but she was there every time. So at the end of the book club, I gave them an index card and said, write your opinions of the book club, just giving me feedback what I can do differently next year or what you want to continue, especially if you're a fifth grader and you're coming again next year. I got the index cards back, and hers said, I wrote this down, I love this book club. It's really nice to be somewhere I can do the things I love. You know, you don't always realize what kind of impact you're having on those kids. And I didn't think she was getting anything out of it, but that is what her card said.
This has been The Reading Culture, and you've been listening to our conversation with Nina LaCour. Again, I'm your host, Jordan Lloyd Bookey, and currently I'm reading The House of Hidden Meanings by RuPaul on audiobook, which is so good, and Camp Sylvania by Julie Murphy. If you enjoyed today's episode, please show some love and give us a 5-star review. It just takes a second and really helps. To learn more about how you can help grow your community's reading culture, check out all of our resources at beanstack.com. And remember to sign up for our newsletter at thereadingculturepod.com/newsletter for special offers and bonus content. This episode was produced by Jackie Lamport and Lower Street Media and script edited by Josiah Lamberto Egan. Thanks for joining, and keep reading.